Hello, and welcome to another episode of Healthy Minds. I'm Julie, your host. This episode is part of our Black Mental Health Matter series. Our special guest joining us for our episode today is Natalie. Would you like to share a little bit about yourself?
Hi, everyone. My name is Natalie Gillard, and I am the creator of Factuality. I have been developing diversity initiatives for 13 years, which led me to the creation of this program. And I am a major, major proponent for Black mental health, all mental health, especially Black mental health.
Great. Thank you so much. So we are going to be talking about environmental racism today and redlining and everything. And part of that, which is going to be really unique, I'm excited, is that we are actually going to be using screen share today to display some images. We'll do our best to provide a really quick description so you have some context if you're just listening. But if you'd like to view the episode and the recording of this episode, you can tune in on the Dragon Digital Media Facebook page. And again, we will be sharing images. We'll do our best to say, hey, we're sharing an image now. This is what it is. So you have an idea, but it might be best to tune in and look at it on the actual video recording. So environmental racism is an interesting term. It's something new that I've learned about in the last few months. And I have thoughts about this, just finding out about it now, I think, which is part of the work that we've been doing as the anti-racism movement has been moving. And it's been really interesting to hear about. And I think people are going to be surprised to hear about what kind of falls under that, but also what they already know about it, maybe just not using this term before. So I have a really quick definition, which is the disproportionate impact of environmental hazards on people of color. And so that's really what we're going to be talking about today. So how did you get into this? So you mentioned you've been doing this for about like 13 years. It's such an interesting niche field, I think, and especially your game that you've developed as well. So I'd love for you to just kind of give us a little bit of background, if that's okay.
Absolutely. This has always been an interest of mine. My mother is an immigrant, so there was always just this love affair, if you will, with cultural diversity. And it's followed me throughout the course of my life. I found myself really interested in finding opportunities, professional opportunities that would allow me to serve people of color, students of color, people from impoverished communities. And that I found myself moving into taking all these courses that were sociology based when I was in college. And from college, wanting to go to grad school, but not finding a program that was of interest and developing a interdisciplinary studies that focused on race and ethnic studies for my grad program. And all the while in grad school, I was working with special needs students, helping them work on acquiring, I think it was like 4 to 6 college credits in 2 years time. So a variety of different disabilities and bringing students through this 2-year program. From there, I connected with the college in Boston, where I was the resident director and advising the multicultural student organization. I then became their coordinator for diversity and left there as a director. And so that's like the origins of this. It's always been an interest. From there, I relocated to Baltimore, had a position working as a director of student leadership and inclusion, and then moved on to Stevenson as the assistant vice president for multicultural experience. But before, while at Notre Dame, I came up with Factuality because I was frustrated with the lack of engagement in these conversations and wanted to find a way to share really important information with people, understanding that I would be inclined to encounter common patterns of resistance. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be lectured at. And I definitely do not wish to be with you all day.
I have some solidarity on the I don't want to be here as a fellow educator. And I love that you did a board game. I'm a huge board game enthusiast. And I think it's really fun anytime you get to like play as you're learning. So can you tell us a little bit about what Factuality is and what you're hoping to maybe demonstrate with it?
It is a 90-minute crash course on structural inequality in the United States. So it's data-driven. I will have people say it's really hard to argue with facts, but you'd be surprised. Once in a while, I do get someone who pushes back on data. And a lot of my data comes from very credible sources, FBI, Census Bureau, NIH, one of the most renowned health organizations in the world. And so it really started when you think about the environmental racism piece, it really started with reimagining what Monopoly would look like if I were a character based on US data. So when you dive into the environmental racism piece, the foundation is redlining. And so considering the history of residential segregation in the United States and thinking about my Blackness on a Monopoly board, could I actually buy a house based on the data or am I most inclined to find myself as a renter, but ultimately on what quarter of that board, the low income side or the high income side? And from there, my brain exploded and I found myself curious about what that would look like for all other racial groups, which led me to factuality.
Super, super interesting. We will be including in the podcast description the social media accounts and website if you want to go explore more about the factuality game. I haven't had the privilege yet of playing, but I really look forward to maybe getting to play this fall. So I recommend that you check it out. It'll be really interesting and hopefully not as vicious as Monopoly games typically turn out. I actually don't play Monopoly with friends anymore because it doesn't ever end well. So hopefully not quite as upsetting, but maybe upsetting in a different way to really, if you haven't thought about some of those inequalities and the differences between groups and what privilege is available to you based on how you look or where your family comes from, which can be really startling to a lot of folks that haven't maybe taken a second to think about what their self brings into the world inherently compared to their brothers and sisters of different colors and abilities and sexual orientation, all that kind of stuff. Okay, so you mentioned redlining and this environmental racism thing. So let's just hop in, right? Let's just get going. So can you talk to us a little bit about maybe like the history of homeownership and maybe like the housing corporation, I think you mentioned as well?
Absolutely. And so this is where I would love to share my screen to add the visual component to the explanation of redlining. So I will do that right now. And so on the screen is a residential security map from the 1930s, and those terms or phrases are interchangeable. And so I want to preface this by saying that I had no idea what redlining was until I relocated to Baltimore. I was living in Boston. I'm from Massachusetts. I lived in Boston for several years before relocating to Baltimore. It was my third time visiting the city, and I never, ever explored the city well when I first visited. And I get off the highway and I see all these abandoned homes and people that looked like me in those communities. And I promise you, even though this is my thing, I judged everything around me. And I think it's really important as a practitioner to share that I do have bias. It's something that I like to own when I realize it. And it's something that I like to reconcile soon after I realize it. It's just important to be transparent there. So I get into Baltimore and all I see is blight. And I didn't even know that term before I relocated. And I read a book called Not in My Neighborhood by Antero Piatela. And that's when I realized that I was gravely mistaken about what I had judged. And it allowed me to really stop and consider what other areas needed reconciling in my life. But back to the homeowners loan corporation and these redlining maps. So the first ordinance for housing segregation was in Baltimore City in 1910. And I think it's really important to highlight that that is the first place where this came into being. Additionally, in Not in My Neighborhood, it lets us know that Abraham Lincoln endorsed segregated living, segregated neighborhoods. So it was endorsed by Abraham Lincoln in accordance with Not in My Neighborhood. And so 1910 first ordinance, by the 1930s and under the Franklin Roosevelt administration was the creation of the Home Owners Loan Corporation. And they created a series of maps of every metropolitan area in this entire country, shading in red all the areas where Black, African American, or the equivalent derogatory term resided. And once the Federal Housing Administration would come into being, they would create a variety of policies that would restrict access to home ownership for Black people. And that would occur through failing to insure their home loans or failing to allocate funding to developers who had aspirations or hopes or intentions of building homes for Black people. It was against the law. In fact, in the book, The Color of Law, they reference the Federal Housing Administration language, which referred to Black people as inharmonious groups. And so this would go on until about 1968 when the Fair Housing Act came into being. And so I just want to focus on this map on the screen for a moment. This is the map of Baltimore. And I did a Google search last night and I'm so mad I didn't screen grab and put it into the slides I'm going to share. But I simply just typed in redlining maps. That's it. And I was flooded. There are over 200 of these maps. And so when you think about racial segregation, in any metropolitan area where there's high crime, look up the map. You will find it. It's right there in a Google search. It's all right in front of your face. And I think oftentimes when we have these conversations about diversity, there's a core group of people that will say, I wasn't alive then, or I didn't own slaves. Yeah, we get that. That's fine. Totally. No one is accusing you of that. But what we are trying to get you to acknowledge is the legacy, the evolution of policy that perpetuates this system present day. We have a 400-year-old problem, and there are origins. Everything has a legacy, and everything has an evolution. So back to this map. So this map is of Baltimore City. And the areas that are, I decided to superimpose a current neighborhood composition against this residential security map from the 1930s. And when I would move those maps in and out, I was able to identify 12 areas that were originally redlined that remain impoverished present day or low income or disenfranchised in some capacity. That's the evolution of policy. You can't ignore the history and the legacy. And so this is for Baltimore City. And again, stressing this happened nationally. And when I travel, or pre-pandemic, when I was traveling, I am very safe, wear your mask, be safe. When I was traveling pre-pandemic, I would ask people, I'd ask the locals, where are you most inclined to find low income communities of color? And I said, if you can identify where that would be on the map, I'd pull the map for their area. The majority of the times, the people, the participants or individuals I would ask would say, yes, they still reside in the red lines. There is data that demonstrates that the majority of the areas in this country that were originally redlined remain people of color and or low income. That's 80 years later. So that's on a federal level. And so here's what happens on a local level. So now I'm sharing a slide that has a deed and agreement. I call them racial covenants. And this is for the neighborhood that I live in. This is for the northwood part of Baltimore City. And I want to say that, I want to stress that my next door neighbor, senior citizen, Black woman, told me that she was able to access, and I'm putting up some air quotes, access the neighborhood by starting off as the help. And then my neighbor across the street says, Natalie, you have to see this document. She's really diligent about going to the homeowners meetings. I'm not. And so she was able to give me this beautiful piece of history. And so on the following slide, I'm going to give you a close-up of this, of the text, which is a strike through. And I also want to preface this by saying that this is under the subheading of no nuisances. And there are references to animals under no nuisances and Black people. And under the strike through, it says, at no time shall the land included in said tract or any part thereof or any building erected thereon be occupied by any Negro or person of Negro extraction. This prohibition, however, is not intended to include the occupancy by a Negro domestic servant. And so that is exactly what my neighbor meant when she said she was able to access this neighborhood by starting off as the help. Something else I'd like to focus on here is the Negro or Negro extraction. First, I couldn't make out the word extraction under the strike through text. So I did a variety of Google searches that led me to another racial covenant for Rogers Forge, which is the Towson area of Maryland, right outside of the city, so Baltimore County. And what's really fascinating, if you will, about the Rogers Forge covenant is that they went through a several year long process to do a full erasure of the racist text. I always side with the strike through because it forces the non-believers to believe. It's going to create some internal conflict for the non-believers. So I prefer to see it, but I'm not upset with them for removing it. I just have my preference. And what's fascinating about Rogers Forge is that there is an apartment complex right across the street from Rogers Forge Elementary. And a couple of years back, they went through this nasty redistricting process that carved out the apartment complex, which is homes to a lot of Black and brown people. And that was in an effort to keep the schools racially segregated. And so now you have children who live in the apartment complex across from an elementary school who will have to take a bus across town to West Towson Elementary. And so we look at the evolution of policy and how this is modernized. They have to take a bus across town to West Towson Elementary. But get this, when it is time for them to go to middle school, they will then walk from their apartment complex, cross the street, pass by, walk in front of the elementary school that they weren't allowed to go to, and head around to the back where the middle school is. And the principal was in one of my sessions and says that she could see this from her window. So again, you have the history, you have the evolution, you have the legacy. And so I also want to share that these policies had major implications, not just for Black people, but for Jewish communities too. I had a participant who said she found the deed to her house. And in that deed, it says no Hebrews, Jewish woman. It says no Hebrews in the deed. So it also had major implications for Asian people. There were a variety of acts that would restrict Asian migration into this country. So again, we're looking at the history, but the legacy has the most significant impact for Black people. We're noticing, we're seeing in the data that since 1968, all of the progress put towards creating equitable housing, because it has been undermined, has basically unraveled all the progress since 1968. The home ownership rates for Black people haven't shifted or haven't been maintained since 1968. It went up and it came right back down. And that's because of present day challenges around racism, lending practices, subprime mortgages, et cetera. It goes on and on. So that's the history behind redlining and the evolution of that practice.
Thank you so much. I think it really adds something to see this crossed out portion of the deed. And I'm glad that you mentioned, because I think people sometimes mistakenly think, you know, it's just Black people being targeted, but that's certainly not the case. Right now, obviously, we're running with the Black Lives Matter, but I think we really need to not only, of course, acknowledge this and move forward and try to fix these inequities or the inequalities and all this, but also acknowledge that there are other groups within the U.S. that are, of course, experiencing the same level of things. And we've talked about this in some of the other Black Mental Health Matters episodes, and we will continue to talk about that as well. And just know that there are many, many little details in here that pop up in the language. And people are often shocked that it's only a generation or two generations ago that it's in the language or still present in the deed today. And people just signed it without reading it, I guess. I don't know. Okay, so we have an idea now that some neighborhoods maybe kind of popped up and were specifically built or designed or kind of later redesigned to put the certain groups of folks, whatever they are, in different areas in the cities. And I will say I grew up in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which is the capital, definitely redlined. I got very curious after talking to Natalie the first time we chatted, and I went and I looked up the maps and I was like, oh, yeah, okay. That's the area of town that I would not feel safe going through because of the crime and all of those kind of things. And sure enough, that was redlined on the map when you go and you Google it. It's really interesting to look. I think many of our listeners probably are going to be Baltimore adjacent, but if you're somewhere else, please Google, look at it and see how that plays up today. So what are some of the impacts? We talked about education, and I think a lot of people can relate to that because they've probably also been subject to weird bus routes and all sorts of things. I know that I had to take a weird bus route through town to get to my school, and I always thought it was very strange because there was a school that was closer. I don't know if this was redlining or strange zoning, or I don't know what was going on there. I'll have to do some digging. But other than education, what are some of these impacts that we can maybe be educated on?
Sure. So residential segregation impacts the quality of the education you receive, the amount of funding that your school receives, the quality of your neighborhood, your housing conditions, your air quality, the likelihood of having asthma, your access to having healthy food, the likelihood of your neighborhood being over-policed. I mean, the list is quite expansive, and that's just going off of what's populating in my mind right now. But when you begin to unpack just those key areas, so for instance, the quality of the education you receive. There was a study released, I want to say, either late last year or earlier this year. Thinking late last year, NPR, many places captured this, that non-white schools received $23 billion less in funding. Non-white school districts received 23, not million. Million would still be really astonishing. $23 billion less in funding. And so coupled with that, when we look at the inadequate funding and the implicit and explicit racism in the classroom experience, because what ends up happening is that we have a lot of, I hear this from many organizations I work with, that the staff doesn't reflect the student body. That's a really common thing. So the absence of cultural competence coupled with the absence of proper funding leads us to implicit and explicit racism, which leads Black children, especially Black boys, to suspension and expulsion. And suspension and expulsion leads to school dropout, which could lead to arrest, which could lead to incarceration, and with that record could lead to unemployment tied to our zip codes. And you had mentioned that neighborhoods or communities that you wouldn't feel safe going to, who created them? Who stripped those communities of the resources? And look at the evolution as a result of those policy makings and the intentional neglect. I also mentioned access to unhealthy food. So we've heard the term food desert, but I'm also hearing the term food swamps. There is food, but the food is unhealthy. It's toxic for your body. And so the average supermarket is 2.9 miles away, but the average access to fast food, unhealthy food, fried food in a low-income community of color is a 5 to 10 minute walk. Now, I will eat that food once in a while. The smell will lure you in. It tastes good. But think about an impoverished family or a low-income family. And also coupling that with the reality that Black and Hispanic populations have the highest amount of poverty and the highest amount of no access, not ownership, no access to a car. If you are financially insecure, financially compromised, are you going to find your way to the supermarket or are you going to take that 5 to 10 minute walk to the fast food option? And as a result, when you look at the data, we are eating the fast food because of the high cases of hypertension and diabetes and obesity. And when that collides with COVID-19, it's twice as deathly for those populations. And so I know we'll get into this later, but what does that mean for your mental health? And so the last piece that I would like to discuss, and I'll also pull up another slide for this, would be the neighborhood temperatures. That is mind-blowing. So I'm going to share my screen again, and that is going to be aerial views. This was captured in a study by NPR, aggregate data, and this on-the-ground study offering aerial views of two different sides of Baltimore. And the differences in these images are glaring. And things you could immediately notice, again, going back to the environmental racism piece, the absence of green space in the image on the left, which is East Baltimore. I'm seeing a lot of rooftops. I'm seeing boarded up homes. I am seeing tremendous amounts of pavement and a very, very minimal green space. But on the right-hand side in Roland Park, which has always been on the cusp of blue and green on the residential security map or the redlining map, I'm seeing trees that have matured quite beautifully over the last 80 years. I'm seeing very few rooftops and a little piece of pavement for a street. And so in accordance with the study, when the sun is beaming down on areas like East Baltimore, and I started pulling aerial views throughout the country, it looks the same anywhere you go. When the sun is beaming down on areas that don't have adequate landscaping, the neighborhood temperatures go up and trigger respiratory challenges, health crisis. Now, what happens when the respiratory challenges collide with a respiratory health crisis? I am very fearful and concerned about what will happen to those communities during the summer months. We are in July in Baltimore. You know it's hot. And when the sun is beaming down on affluent spaces like Roland Park, the tree canopies serve as a buffer that's allowing cooler neighborhood temperatures. I had a participant tell me that her neighborhood's being gentrified and there were some workers who were putting trees into the neighborhood saying to her, oh, these trees, when they mature, it's gonna make your neighborhood 7 degrees cooler is what they told her. So we know this to be the case. And what are we doing about it? And so when this country was busy suburbanizing America and creating these spaces that were exclusive to white Americans, all the while being neglectful of the spaces that Black people were forced into, we were not just neglectful, we were neglectful for resources holistically. And when it comes to the environmental piece, the absence of adequate environmental coverings are creating additional or exacerbating additional health concerns for people in those communities.
Thank you. I think we've had an episode briefly talking about the importance of nature and green spaces on our mental health, the one with our British guests a while back. So I know it seems really trivial, but especially if you're in an area that doesn't have a lot of green, it really does weigh you down. I feel like when I'm walking through a city and there's no green, you kind of just feel stressed, like busy. And it's just, it's really interesting that it not only of course plays into your mental health and of course plays into the physical health. Like I would be less likely probably to go for a walk in a city area than somewhere that's green, right? So that's a really simple kind of switch to put trees in and have these areas for parks. Of course, it's a little bit more difficult now with houses and businesses already established, but I really like this visual and I hope that you all take a second to either Google these images or come to the video and look at them yourself. But it's very startling. One looks kind of like a city desert and one looks like a forest with some trees in it, with some houses in it. So I'm really glad you brought up the COVID-19 impact as well, because we are seeing a disproportionate impact on people of color, especially Black Americans. And, you know, of course, obesity plays into that, the underlying respiratory issues as well. And then there's also the access to healthcare piece, which I think is important to acknowledge and talk about really briefly. So if you're in one of these neighborhoods and you're a doctor or a medical professional, I feel like, one, you probably wouldn't stay in that neighborhood if you have the funds to leave. You know, if you have a choice between the city with no trees and a treed area with the access to better education and all that, most folks are going to choose to probably leave, although some would stay and be committed to hoping and helping their community. But the better doctors or just access to doctors are probably not in that community, right?
I rely on facts, so I can't fully say sure, but what I would like to extract from what you're saying is the evident privilege that one has to opt out of living in these communities. So thinking about the surrounding areas in East Baltimore of Johns Hopkins and knocking down older homes and flipping homes that you could acquire for $40,000 and putting them back on the market for several times the price. And it does go, there's a lot of incentives for doctors to stay in the area. Some do, but I don't have the data on that. But I just really want to highlight that it is an opt-in, opt-out. It is a privilege to be able to opt out of living in this environment that other people have been forced into.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's really interesting because as Dr. Nadine Burke Harris, I'm not sure if you're familiar with her, she did the study. She did some work in California on adverse childhood experiences. And so she chose to stay in her neighborhood and work in a disadvantaged, poor, vulnerable neighborhood. And it's really interesting to hear her. She's an excellent TED Talk. I've talked about her a million times. She's one of my favorite people. I don't know her, of course, but I'm really inspired by what she's brought in and what she shares with us. And so I think about that a lot because there is a ton of privilege, you know, if you're fortunate enough to make it, to get a good education, to make it into college, to make it to grad school, to make it to medical school, if you're fortunate enough to do all of these steps, you know, and then you choose to stay in a neighborhood that you know that maybe you don't have access or that it's going to be a little bit more difficult for you to live there versus, you know, paying a little bit more and living outside of your neighborhood to make your life perhaps a little bit easier or maybe even healthier when we're talking about some of these real impacts. I want to come back really quickly to the food deserts, food swamp. I've actually never heard the term food swamps before. I'm really intrigued by that. And I just want to clarify, you know, not only are the supermarkets further away, right, but they also have less selection and especially in the produce and perishable aspects. Maybe, you know, I go to my grocery store and I have like 5 or something within like 3 or 4 miles of me. It's really ridiculous. And I'm in Glen Burnie, to be clear. It's not like I'm living it up in like a super fancy area or anything, but I have so many grocery stores around me and I love when I walk in and there's just very visually appealing to see all these fruits and vegetables everywhere. And I've also been in Harrisburg and Baltimore, and I've gone to grocery stores in areas that are not as economically privileged. And it's really interesting to see how much smaller the produce sections are, how much more stuff like Cheez-Its, I'm not knocking them, I love them, but you know, stuff that's going to be long-lasting and shelf-stable is available. And again, that has a really real impact on your health and subsequently your mental health. Can you talk to us a little bit about food swamps? I'm just very curious about that.
Sure. So I want to talk about the reason why we're more inclined to see fast food options over supermarkets in low-income areas, which will lead us to the food swamps. And it obviously comes down to the bottom line, capitalism, which runs this country. So let's just throw this out here. A 500 square foot fast food eatery, carry out, take out, whatever the equivalent term is, has a far greater yield, far greater bottom line than a 5,000 square foot supermarket. So we have a tendency to see more of those food options in low income spaces, tighter spaces anyway, and largely because the bottom line, that yield, is far greater than the supermarket. 500 square feet divided by 5,000 gives you way much more money than the 5,000 square foot supermarket. And if you do have a supermarket in your community, low-income community, you are totally right. The produce section is always severely compromised. There are certain markets I know I can't go to because they will never have fresh whatever I'm looking for, or that it's going to be fresh food but packaged. So I can't just go grab my romaine lettuce off the shelf or the spinach that I would like to eat. It's going to come in a package and I can still consume that, but you just notice that the quality is very different when you look at the low-income supermarkets. But largely because of the bottom line, we're seeing fast food eateries in low-income spaces, and that is what the food swamp is. So there is food, but the food is unhealthy. The food is contributing to health problems. The food is leading you to hypertension, diabetes, obesity, and that can compromise your quality of life. It could shorten your life, most certainly. It creates a lot of poor health outcomes. And that's why there's the term the swamp, because it's not a desert. There's food, but it's probably not what you would like to consume on a daily basis, or should consume on a daily basis if you are concerned about your health.
And then something else just to mention is that in the poorer neighborhoods, people are more likely to work longer hours or more strenuous hours. And I think we all can relate to being tired and stressed and not wanting to cook dinner. And so that's, again, just another reason that folks may turn to fast food, myself included. I want to be very, very clear. You know, when I'm tired and I'm stressed and you want comfort food or something that's easy or fast, you're going to go for those delicious chicken nuggets or the French fries or something that's close by and cheap, and often cheaper than the quote unquote real food that's available at the grocery store that you have to spend 40 minutes to cook, which is just something that a lot of people don't have the luxury to do. And I think a lot of folks are recognizing that in the pandemic, if they've been home, that it certainly, I've been cooking a lot more than I usually do. But it's really interesting to see, one, how boring that gets quickly, like if you're not somebody that enjoys cooking. Two, like how tedious it is to think about your meal plan. And again, I please recognize, I know I have a ton of privilege saying these statements, but you know, you're like, oh my God, I have to think of something else to make. I had pasta 3 times last week. Now I have to do it again. So screw it. I'm going to drive through McDonald's or Wendy's or whatever, because it's close by. It's fast. It's cheap. I don't have to think about it. It tastes good. And it, you know, sets off the dopamine in my brain. So I'll feel a little bit better. But then we know that the long-term impact, of course, of having McDonald's, Wendy's, whatever, multiple times a week, it really does take a really large physical toll on your mental health and physical health overall. So we've been hinting about mental health, and I think we just need to get into it here. So, you know, we've been kind of talking about it, sprinkling it around. The impacts of living in an area that's been redlined, what would you say on somebody's mental health? What do you think being redlined would do to somebody's mental health?
So first I want to say that people in these, in the reference communities, have a lot of challenges reaching services, workplaces, et cetera, outside of their communities. So you're kind of just stuck in these communities because of those constraints. And so in general, on average, Black people are 20% more likely to experience psychological distress. We all can encounter psychological distress, but we are seeing that it is that Black people are 20% more likely to encounter psychological distress. So I decided in preparation for our time together to look at the intersection of poverty. And I didn't get a number, but when you factor poverty into this equation, it exacerbates the condition of the mental health. It makes it way worse. And it was somewhat like a catch-22 where being impoverished can exacerbate mental health, but poor mental health could lead you to poverty. And so it's just, you're just seeing, it's kind of like this yo-yo going back and forth where chicken or the egg, like one leads to the other, the other leads to the other. And so noticing just with that data, 20% more. And so what happens when you are living in that low-income community, what happens when the summer months hit, but because of poor infrastructure for your home and the absence of AC, you're inclined to be outside, where we have a tendency to see violence spike because it's creating additional opportunities for crime. So your mental health is going to be poor, but we're seeing that people of color are the least likely. I'm seeing a movement for sure to manage your mental health better, but we're seeing that people of color are the least inclined to explore those services. And I could even say for men of color that I love, if I mention therapy, the T word, it's like, what? And it's like, that's the best thing that I've ever done for myself. I started going to therapy when I was 19. That's almost 20 years now. And it was the best thing I could ever do. But there's a lot of stigma around focusing on that aspect of your health. But it's the greatest thing that you could ever do for yourself, finding a good therapist. And especially for people of color, making sure that your therapist is culturally competent, because you might not find the best fit on the first try, but you have to keep trying. And when you are in distress, it is hard to get connected to those services, but it is imperative that your therapist is culturally competent to help you mitigate the challenges or how nuanced it is to be a person of color going through these structural inequities.
Thank you so much. So much good stuff to unpack there. So first, I just want to, this is the psych professor in me coming out, I apologize. So the concept of mental health impacting your SES, your socioeconomic status, is called downward drift. And so the idea is that, especially on the severe mental illness, so I don't want to, you know, of course, it's a spectrum really quick. If this is the first time you're listening in to me, it's a spectrum of mental health. So you can be mild, moderate, severe, anywhere in between. You can oscillate up and down the spectrum on a daily basis, weekly, but like whatever, right? So on the severe side, which is rare in comparison to the mild and moderate, the more severe side will lead to impacts in your ability to go to school, to go to work, to live your daily life, which then of course automatically kind of leads you to be dropping down into the lower levels of the socioeconomic status. So this is the downward drift phenomenon. I love that you said chicken, egg. That's something I say with my students all the time. I literally just say chicken, egg, and they all look at me and they get used to me eventually. But it's true, right? So we look at the data of poverty and mental health, and it's about 2-to-1, they say, for poverty to the middle and upper classes. The lower classes are about 2-to-1. So I'm 2 times more likely to have a mental health problem, but it's a chicken and egg scenario. So thank you. Thank you for saying that. If any students are listening, chicken, egg, chicken, egg. So, the second piece, I'm so glad you brought up therapy. Thank you so much for sharing your own experience with that. I also have been to therapy, you know, various times throughout my life. I think it's really important. Everybody needs a therapist. Everybody does. You need somebody to listen to you and tell you that you're wrong in a nice way and help you learn those patterns to break out of some of those negative patterns that we've all learned throughout our lives. Cultural competence is incredibly important. I think that we're seeing a little bit of a revolution around mental health. I'm very excited about it. Definitely in the 10 years I've been in the field, that it's changed drastically what we've seen. You know, before it was like, oh, don't talk about it, right? And now, now we're getting a little bit better. Like, you're able to say the T word to your friends and they can hear it, but maybe not acknowledge it yet. Maybe that's another couple of years down the road. But it's incredibly important that if you're listening, and if you're a person of color, if you're a male, even if you're anything outside of our white female standard, that you think about this and think about if it's a field you want to go into, because you are drastically underrepresented in this field and we need you to come talk to our population. It should not be a bunch of white females in the mental health field, hello, talking about their experience. Although, you know, I hope that I have something valid to say. I definitely can't speak for, you know, everybody else that has an experience that's been different from mine. The mark of a good therapist, though, is that they have listened and they've done their work and they're able to separate their bias as much as possible from listening to their clients or friends or whoever. So thank you for the quick therapy PSA there. I also kind of want to talk about like the generational implications of what this does. So, you know, everybody's like, oh, well, you know, okay, boomer, right? But it has a real impact on us today, millennials and Generation Z, all of that stuff. We need to talk about what it meant that your grandparents couldn't buy a house in a certain neighborhood, or, you know, generational wealth, all that kind of stuff. I'll let you talk. You'll do a much better job.
So that's the most sobering part, just the absence of generational wealth for Black people. Focusing on Roland Park for a moment, I don't know, I can't identify one family that has told me this, but I work with a lot of schools in that corridor in North Baltimore, and I've heard many stories about how people are living in those homes and just paying taxes because it's been passed down, passed down, passed down. And so that affords you a lot of life's luxuries that other people will never get to encounter in a lifetime. And I was looking up some data the other night, and Black wealth in comparison to white wealth, solely because of the generational piece, was multiplied the amount of, it's just way more wealth that white families have in comparison to Black families. And a large portion of it has everything to do with the ability to pass properties or other gifts, and sometimes without paying taxes on them, down from one generation to the next. And the bulk of generational wealth comes from property ownership. And so if you have a core racial group that wasn't allowed to own homes, or for that core racial group, and I'll just say for Black people, one, to not be able to own homes, and two, to see that the homes are undervalued. Why is it that the same house that I own in Baltimore worth almost $1 million in Washington, D.C.? Why is it that, because I looked, and to find the exact home in D.C. in an affluent space, it was about $800,000 plus for the same exact home. Why is it in Baltimore, where the economy is a little bit different and the socioeconomic status a little bit different, why is the same house across town in a predominantly white neighborhood worth over $500,000? The same exact house. There was a local station did a comparison of homes in Edmondson Village, which is on the west side of Baltimore, and maybe homes in the county like Rogers Fork or something. Identical homes, night and day values. So you pass that home down to someone and you're seeing the same quality of home valued at way less. And so there's less generational wealth. Or considering financial literacy, especially for Black and Brown communities, or the absence, lack thereof, of financial literacy. So more inclined, or at times we will sell the home versus passing it down, or who's going to pay for taxes and just pay the taxes. But the taxes have a tendency to spike for homes in Black and Brown communities way faster than they do for predominantly white communities. I was looking at that data the other day. So an inability to manage your home will largely come down to your taxes. My mortgage has increased several hundred dollars within 3 years, solely because of taxes. So taxes are higher in Black neighborhoods, which can make it more challenging to hold on to that home. And then if you are looking at the intersection of impoverished communities, could you imagine what it looks like when someone comes and knocks on your door and says, I want to give you $40,000 cash for this home that has been in a neighborhood that's been under-resourced for however many decades. Can you imagine for the first time in your life, somebody wants to hand you that sum of money? And so you say, sure, I'll take it. And then they knock that house down, they level that house, and they put it back on the market for 10 times the amount that they got it from you. And then that whole area gets gentrified. And now no one can afford to live in that space. So those are all the things that we have to consider. And then when you leave that house to the next generation and that property continues to go up and goes up and goes up, who is the one, which group is holding on to the wealth? And so again, that's why the history is so critical here, because if you weren't allowed, and then when you were allowed, the homes are valued less and you have the opportunity to pass it down, how is that group going to amass wealth if you were the one that's been disenfranchised?
Yeah, really, really powerful to think about this. And I just want to, as a white person, hello, checking in, I want to acknowledge that a lot of people that are white have not been given houses, and a lot of them are not doing this. It's, you know, if we talk about not necessarily the 1%, but it is a smaller percentage. And, you know, we can only talk about averages. So if you're listening, you're like, well, I never got a house. Okay, but stop and think about where you lived, what access you had to some of these areas, you know, what quality of air, I know that we didn't really unpack that too much, but the temperature, but quality of air, the food you were given, you know, what resources your parents had, and that builds, right? So I come from a family where everybody has a master's degree. I'm working on my PhD, right? So right from the very, very start, I knew that I was going to be going on to graduate school. I knew that I was, and this was just like something I knew. It wasn't ever something I questioned. I had excellent education. I'm so fortunate. And some of this stuff could be access to scholarships, to loans, right? These kind of things that really start to play in that you have access to because of the area that you live. And this comes from your parents because you didn't, you know, pop out and go, oh, guys, this isn't a great neighborhood for me. Let's, you know, roll over here. That's not something that happened, right? So your parents, where they brought you up, has a really significant impact on where your future is going to go. And I know people don't love to hear that because they feel defensive. And that's a natural reaction to acknowledging privilege of any kind where you're at. And it does feel uncomfortable to realize that you benefited from a system that others are being squished by, right? And so just take a moment and reflect and think about what areas of privilege that you've had in your life. Like I said, I'm incredibly privileged to come from a highly educated background. I never had a shortage of books. I even, you know, my mom stopped buying them for me after a while because she got sick of how expensive it was, but I went to the library literally 2 to 3 times a week. Not all communities have access to a quality library that are around them. Digitally now we have more options, but this is just stuff to really stop and think about where you live and what kind of impact that has on your entire life, really, where you're brought up in your childhood. And then the other one piece that we didn't explicitly say, and I hope you've been thinking about this, is if you are a young Black child living in a neighborhood that's mostly concrete, right, that probably has some crime running around, your air isn't great, it's hot, especially in July in Baltimore, and you look and you drive past these beautiful tree neighborhoods or you interact with children of other neighborhoods, just stop and think about what impact that would have on your mental health, really, truly. Like to look at these kids and be like, why do they get to live in this neighborhood? Why am I over here, right? And it's a lot for a little child to grasp, but you start to already see the shift of otherization, right? Where like these people get this and I don't. And the people around me look like this and the people over there look like that. So just, I hope that you take a moment and really think about where your background was, what advantages or, you know, sorry, parents listening, disadvantages maybe you had due to your background and start to think about what that played into your life. So I want to mention, you've talked about like the history a whole lot, but so 1968 was the end, quote unquote, end of some of these unfair practices. But really, what have we seen since then, maybe on the lightly less legal side of things or very legal side of things that continue the system?
So I really appreciate everything you just said in the last set of comments and around the whole privilege piece and how there are varying types of privilege and that it's not just getting a house, but it's being able to have your down payment for a home or being able to get out of college without tremendous debt. It goes beyond that. And so I just wanted to thank you for putting that out there because someone could easily poke holes. Well, I didn't get a house, but you're missing the point. So thank you for that piece. And so what is happening present day? So you put in air quotes since 1968. So yeah, on paper, we said that we wouldn't do certain things. And there was a study released late last year, a several year investigation into a real estate office in Long Island, where they found that Black people were the least likely to have traction when trying to own a home out of all racial groups that were part of this experiment. And you would see hidden cameras of the lenders or the mortgage reps or whoever was involved. I'm going to call them all real estate professionals, where you will see that a Black family would come in and they would say, I need to see your license. You need to get a pre-approval before I could show you any properties. And then the properties that they would show these Black and Hispanic families would be in Black and Hispanic neighborhoods that were low income. So rarely showing these individuals homes in more affluent spaces. And then you have a white person come in to meet with the same person. It's like, well, let me show you what we have. Not asking for the license, not asking for the pre-approval, and oh, you don't want to live in this neighborhood. That neighborhood has X, Y, and Z. Let me show you these beautiful homes in predominantly white spaces. And that still happens. I mean, there's plenty of data. There's a really good podcast that I listened to last year, I want to say, about this Black woman who was trying to find a home in the Philadelphia area. And I think another investigation where a white couple that wasn't as credentialed, didn't have as much money saved, having a plethora of options, that weren't extended to her. I want to say she was in an interracial relationship, Black woman, white male. And so we're still, for every structural inequity, there are origins. And what we are living through right now is the evolution. So it's kind of modernized. There are some loopholes that these challenges get placed into, but we haven't made a significant shift. And you can see that again in the home ownership rates for Black people, the present day racial segregation of neighborhoods, what areas are being gentrified. The majority of areas that are presently being gentrified were originally redlined spaces. So we're still seeing it happen in a plethora of ways.
Yeah, and I just want to mention this because I think it deserves to be called out, not only here, but literally everywhere. So the idea of adding barriers, this like adding steps. So as a former case manager, I was always surprised at how stacked the system is against people that do not have somebody in the know or somebody to advocate for them, push back, to question. And again, this is probably my privilege, but I feel very comfortable questioning people on why they're doing things that way. And I'm happy to push through and I'm happy to do all that. But I also know that I'm not going to be likely targeted or, you know, have a lot of like pushback, essentially. If I say, you know, can you explain why this is happening? People normally are like, oh, well, that was an error, you know, whatever, like they're happy to kind of accommodate. But I've also experienced watching my former clients who were people of color with severe mental illnesses, so like a double whammy, right? They're trying to ask the same questions and the doctors aren't paying attention. You know, people aren't paying attention. There's extra steps. The process of applying for medical assistance has gotten a little bit better, but it is obnoxious. Yeah. It's obnoxious unless you have somebody that's done it before to show you how to go through this. And this is probably one of the most used tools are when we're talking about systematic racism, when we're talking about white privilege, it's this adding like bureaucracy and process and barriers into things that make it so complicated for people that are either systematically squished, as I said earlier, very elegantly, or they're systematically held back, or they don't understand that it can be, you know, different if they push back, or maybe they get labeled as an angry Black woman or an angry Black man or dangerous or violent, right? We've talked about that before in a podcast. We'll continue exploring it in this series. But it's so important to recognize that this Karen meme that's running around, it's because this white female middle-aged lady hasn't ever experienced a lot of this discrimination and stuff. And so she yells at the manager and gets her way. But if somebody else that does that is not a, you know, middle-aged white person, they get the police called on them, right? Or they get thrown out of the business. And so it's really important to recognize that this rules, the guidelines, the boundaries are all things that we need to start pushing back on, especially if you have privilege, to dismantle the system and help protect people that have been targeted by these policies. And so always gently push back if you can, or get angry if you're able to, right? But ask why these barriers are being put in place. So a classic example is, I think it was Kentucky or Tennessee, I can't remember, and honestly, I confused the two of them. But anyway, they closed like all the voting district, like the voting areas recently. Kentucky, okay. So they had like one voting place. Voting is another, we don't even have enough time to talk about it, but voting, oh my goodness, voting. Please go do your education on this yourself. Maybe we'll come back for another episode on this. But the gerrymandering, all this stuff, hand in hand with redlining, all this to work to keep system people down, right? So we only have a couple minutes left. So I hope that the pushback, if you're privileged, the pushback on systems is definitely something you can do. What else do you think people should do to fix some of these processes? I know that this is unfair for you to solve the system for us, so please do so in 2 minutes. No, I'm just kidding. Please give us maybe a couple of ideas or steps or whatever you feel comfortable sharing. What would you suggest?
It really starts with yourself, and you have to hold yourself accountable for the ways in which that you contribute or perpetuate what is the ongoings of this system. And so if you notice something and you don't say anything about it, shame on you. Hold yourself accountable, use your voice. One of my really good friends, Jen, she would say, if you are trying to get comfortable with using your voice, especially for white people, if you hear something insensitive or racist joke, or it's really common to hear, oh, I have, but it's just Uncle so-and-so, or it's just, okay, well then stop giving this person a pass. And when they say the next racist or sexist or homophobic thing, ask them to clarify. What did you mean by that? I'm not quite following you, because it puts their back against the wall and it forces them to realize that what they said was actually trash. So it starts with you. Figure out ways that you can contribute, hold yourself accountable, and use your voice.
Yeah, thank you. One of my favorite things to do is just ask why that's funny. And I've used it for mental health jokes forever. I say, I don't really understand that. Can you explain it? Or I don't find that funny. Why do you think it's funny? And people are always like, oh, because I'm a trash human being, right? Or I was brought up by people that didn't teach me any better. Something that I've advocated for in every single episode always is to educate yourself. So if you're brought up in one area with all the same kind of people, you do not have the privilege, the honor of hearing different voices from your own. And it's really important that in your anti-racist work that I hope that you're all undertaking, that you don't forget about the happy side of things either. So yes, buy Ibram Kendi's book. Yes, buy Leila Ephsat. Yes, but also go find some Black fantasy authors. Go find, things that are happy too. It's not just racism in this whole discussion, although that's what we're focusing on at the moment.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so it's time for my favorite part of the episode, which is self-care send-off. So Natalie, what would you give to the people listening to either challenge them or encourage them in their self-care practice? What would you recommend?
So it's a fusion of the two. And recently I have been going through some things and I'm doing well, but I've been going through some things and I've realized once again that I am the common denominator. We are the cause and the cure of the grief in which we experience and encounter. And so although awful things could be happening to you, you have to stop, hold yourself accountable. Here is that accountability piece again, and identify where you are a factor in that equation. And by holding yourself accountable and limiting the capacity, because we are creating space for these bad things to happen to us. That's why we are at fault. We are the cause and the cure. So by limiting the capacity that you have to entertain things that don't make you feel good, it'll then lend itself to offering more time for the aspects of self-care that actually feel good.
I love it. Okay, so reflection and accountability. Excellent, excellent, excellent tools. And it can be uncomfortable, again, to recognize that you're part of the problem. And our brain tries to trick us out of thinking that too. So it does take practice to recognize that. Thank you so, so much, Natalie, for joining us today. I really appreciate your expertise, your knowledge, your passion. It was wonderful to have this discussion with you. We are going to continue these throughout July. So every Tuesday, you'll see an episode posted. So please tune in. Share them, ask us questions. You can find Natalie's social media information in our description, and we are wishing you good mental health.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.